Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back on, it's like the first day of school for me and you, Martin. This is like the first day of school. We were excited. I was up early. I had the lunches packed. I had your water in your flask. I had all the stuff ready, and you were still in the scratcher. But nonetheless, we're excited.
So you're so old school. Nobody does that anymore, Tony. You have your nice little treats going to school. You have your grapes. You have your strawberries. You have your ionized water, you know, it all has to be sanitary. So, you know, you're so far behind, Tony.
Oh, man, listen, what was it? The knockoff Club Milk bars. You remember the handy bars you got?
Yeah. The Penguin knockoffs.
Exactly. Yeah. Living. And if you were lucky, you got a Capri Sun on a Friday. Anyway, look, politics is back, folks. And we are delighted to be joined via Zoom by West Cork TD, Social Democrat spokesperson for agriculture, disability and social justice, Holly Cairns. Holly, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for having me on.
I'd say you're less excited than we are, to be honest with you. We're complete nerds, but how are you on the day where everybody's back, the recess is over, and we're looking at, as I called it, season two of Fine Gael?
Yeah, well, it's actually really good to be back. Like, it's quite frustrating over the summer when big issues come up and you can't raise them in the Dáil. You know, there was loads of issues just even say with the local hospital in my constituency. And, you know, it really is the case that ministers can just ignore your emails and phone calls during that time. So without that kind of avenue of raising issues, it's quite frustrating. But at the same time, I didn't miss the 4.5 hour commute. So, you know, pros and cons.
Yeah. You mentioned issues over the summer, and it would be remiss of me not to ask, because I know today that Sinn Féin are going to table a bill of no confidence in the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, and the entire affair does, and they of their own admission, was not handled correctly. It stinks of stroke politics. I remember Enda Kenny putting a former gentleman onto the arts committee just to get them this experience, and actually standing up in the Dáil and saying mea culpa, if you recall, that was the phrase he used. I got it wrong and admitted to it. But I also know that the Sock Dems have continuously spoken about anti-corruption and white-collar crime and different models. So can I get your sense of A, the actual incident, and B, what you guys would do that would be different?
Absolutely. And it's one of the things, like, you know, my perception of politics in Ireland before I got into it was just that it was so corrupt. Like, I finished school in 2008, around the time of the crash, and I remember just thinking, like, politics was almost like a dirty word. You know, absolutely no faith in them whatsoever. And probably one of the reasons I joined the Social Democrats is that Catherine Murphy, Social Democrats co-leader, always stood out to me as somebody who did things completely different and saw things completely differently, kind of exposing corruption all around her with the FAI, with Dennis O'Brien, all of that stuff. So it's something they're very strong on. And I really felt like that, it's, you know, so much about policy is so important, in terms of how you govern, but like your approach to politics and the style of politics is also crucially important. And, you know, I talked about my perception of Irish politics before I went into it or around the time finishing school. But there's like a widespread belief in Ireland that there's one law for some and another law for others. You hear that anecdotally, but it's also born out of research. So in 2009, a Eurobarometer report found that 86% of Irish people surveyed think that corruption is a major problem within Ireland, and 70% think the government's effort to combat corruption are not effective. So we know corruption is an issue that concerns most people, I think, and it can make people feel really angry, understandably, leads to an unfair allocation of resources and totally disempowers people and makes them feel like there's no point in taking part in democracy. And that is very damaging. So we know that, like, corruption by its nature can be difficult to prove. So that's why surveys and statistics on corruption are often compiled on the basis of those public perception surveys. It's important to note the reason for highlighting that one.
Yeah, no, I can I come in on that and I'll let you come back in, but I think it's really important to point that out, that perception, the reason, and it's a phrase we use on the podcast all the time, and I'm killed for saying it so often. Martin says to me, Tony, you say that too often, but quite often the crime is what's legal. So it's not necessarily corruption. But I can go, I will say this definitively to give an example. I've seen the speech where former Fine Gael Senator Michael Darcy advocated for this bill that was passing, and within the bill it was contained references to how these international funds would operate and how it would operate in Ireland. I think it was 11 days later he resigned his seat and then announced that he was taking up a position representing these same funds that were on page 42 of this bill that he was supporting. Again, nothing illegal happened, nothing but something that the public must look at and go, actually, that's why I think things are really dodgy when it goes down, because that, to me, says it might not be illegal, but it certainly should be wrong.
That's it, in the kind of lame cooling off period that often isn't even acknowledged. But so far, like, the most common way of dealing with corruption in Ireland has been judge tribunals, which are incredibly costly, obviously, to the taxpayer. And they have been effective in exposing malpractices in high places, but they've often fueled warranted public criticism for the cost of them and the way that it's set up. So we've had things like the Beef Tribunal, which is one that really still stands out to me because it has yet to actually be addressed. Nothing was really done about that. Same with the McCracken investigation. I think all of them, they've never really resulted in people being properly held to account, and they've cost the state so much money. So ultimately, you know, for the Social Democrats, one of our core policies that we believe we need to have an anti-corruption agency that would deal with these things. So for white-collar crime in Ireland, we currently have the Office of the Director of Corporate Enforcement. And soon the Corporate Enforcement Authority will be established. And, you know, we welcome that, but it's all about resources. So the number of guards currently sectioned to office, that is just 7, and that will increase to 16. But in reality, we need more resources than that. So we believe that if Ireland wants an effective means of preventing and prosecuting corruption and white-collar crime, then we need, you know, sort of to tie that into the Lobbying Act, to bring forward a new act in relation to anti-corruption, and that it would kind of, you know, instead of always setting up a tribunal, that we'd have a standing commission that would be investigating and overseeing, for example, like recently we've seen the so-called Housing for All policy, which is very clearly led by developers. So we need a constant overseeing body to ensure that that kind of thing isn't happening, and that is properly resourced, that ties in, you know, the Consumer Act, the Lobbying Act, which we all know isn't that effective. Like, we saw that with the Catherine Zappone thing this week. Like, it's not as if she lodged that lobbying with the, you know, it's not effective.
Only recently we saw where one Fine Gael TD noted that former colleague Noel Rock lobbied them for this issue and another didn't. So, you know, it was like, well, one put it on the register and the other didn't. So they couldn't even identify within the one party who had been lobbied and who had not. And they both received the same requests, I should say, for access. So it's interesting, but it is absolutely, I think the lobbying register, thank God we have it, but it just doesn't work in terms of, it's clear if you just say, well, I didn't think I was being lobbied, so I don't need to put it down.
There's no effective remedy for corruption or perceived corruption in Ireland. We heard this week from the Criminal Assets Bureau how much money they had reclaimed from going after drugs criminals, but that's not exclusively what it was set up for. It was meant to go after corruption everywhere, but it doesn't. It only targets what I would call your blue-collar criminals. It does not target white-collar criminals. There is no effective means. SIPO is toothless. They have no way to censure anybody. So effectively, we have a system that's set up. And as Leo Varadkar showed us himself, he targets his a particular section of society and another section of society walks free.
Martin, I want to come back to Holly, but I just want to make one point, and this is not to sensationalize it, but it's very clear when you mentioned the Office of Corporate Enforcement, Director of Corporate Enforcement, it was very interesting that there was 4 times more Gardaí deployed to deal with Paul Murphy around the water charges than there were that worked on the Anglo trial. So that'll give you the, you know, when you think in terms of what mattered to the state, that is an indictment of what actually where our resources are put. Holly, what else would you guys propose though to tackle this?
Basically, we would have an anti-corruption agency that would do things like have a standing commission of investigation to avoid those costly tribunals. It would assume responsibility for the Corporate Enforcement Authority, Lobbying and the Consumer Protection Commission, and advise public bodies and oversee public procurement and operate on principle public interest, not special interests. That has yet to be established. And after everything that you guys just highlighted, our history with tribunals, it's really something that we don't have that already, but that is a core Social Democrats policy.
It has been a Soc Dems policy for a long, long time. I mean, I remember Catherine, I think at the very close to the setup of the Soc Dems talking about this.
Yeah, I think it was one of their real motivations for forming a party that we need to start doing politics in a different way. This old style, this, you know, golden circle, revolving door, all of those things, like it has to change. And like the public is ready for that change. It's one of the things that I always find so fascinating about Irish politics is like the public is always ahead of the government in relation to these changes. We saw it with marriage equality. We saw it with the referendum to repeal the eighth, that like the public have to drag the elected governments along to the change that everybody wants. They're never leading that change. And this is just another example of it. We're seeing the public outcry and the public pressure for something to be done about this and just nothing. You know, so it always kind of baffles me that despite the public being, you know, dragging the government along to change things like marriage equality, that we don't just start electing parties that are going to lead that change instead of be kind of forced into it all the time. But, you know, luckily we are in charge of our countries by virtue of who we elect to run it. And I think there is kind of a sea change in how people are making that decision. I think we really saw that in the last election and I'm kind of excited for the next one because I think people are really, truly, finally ready to see an end of that same group of people running the show and making a bags of it.
There are other issues coming up for you as well, Holly. It's the review of the repeal legislation is coming up as well. Am I right about that?
You are indeed.
Hang on. I wanted to ask Holly, how are we going to vote? How are the Soc Dems going to vote later?
The Social Democrats are voting no confidence. But I should highlight and probably something I should have spoken about more because sometimes I get criticised for not voting, but I'm in a pairing agreement with the Minister for Justice. So I won't actually be voting, but my Social Democrats colleagues will be voting no confidence. But just to highlight to some of your listeners, because I often get criticised for this so-called not voting, I just want to highlight that if I reneged on my agreement to pair with the minister, that would result in her returning to the Dáil to vote and then our votes cancelling each other out, except I would deprive a minister of her maternity leave. So I just want to explain that to your listeners.
I think that's really important because it shows the patriarchal nature of our thing. And what you've done, obviously, was something that people have said it was an honourable thing to do, yet it shows that the nature of our parliament and how it still needs so much more reform and so much further to travel when it comes to how we treat both sexes equally. And that is very clear within that. And I think I'm glad that you clarified that. But I also just wanted to get on the record. The Soc Dems will be voting no confidence. Sorry, Martin, I cut across you.
Oh, you're muted, Martin, but I know so, yes, it was sorry. The repeal review.
It was the repeal review. Yes, sorry, Holly, it was the repeal review.
Yeah, so I'm really glad that we're reviewing this legislation. Obviously, you know, the existing legislation has been in place for a while now, and now we kind of have all of that feedback from service providers and service users of how this legislation is working. And there is still very many issues with it. So in advance of the kind of review of this, and I'll be spokesperson for the Social Democrats on it, I had meetings with various different groups, one of which was TFMR, which everyone will remember from the referendum. And I remember canvassing, you know, in Cork Southwest for repeal. And the thing that really got people on the doors and that really got people, I think, you know, on the airways and everything was those women who had to travel abroad when they needed terminations for medical reasons. And unfortunately, the legislation that we have in place now is still forcing people to travel for terminations for medical reasons. And during a pandemic and all of those things, that was particularly stressful and harrowing. The stories are really, really difficult to even hear. And I think what we can't do again is have a national debate about, you know, do you or don't you agree with abortion? Like that's done. And what we can't do again is kind of get these women and families who've been through, you know, hell to come out and tell their stories to try and make sure that, you know, the women that go after them are able to access terminations for medical reasons. So I think we just, you know, this time when we're reviewing the legislation, we have to be looking at the evidence, you know, looking at how the service works. So there's, you know, very strict kind of rules on what a fatal fetal anomaly is in Ireland, that the doctor has to be sure that the baby will only survive up to a specific number of days. And it's really, really hard for a doctor to say that, you know, for sure. You don't know if it's going to be 10 days, a month, you know, it's very, very difficult. And it's still a criminal offence then in Ireland for the medical practitioners. We need to remove the criminalisation, and we need to ensure that women who need terminations for medical reasons get them as early as possible, but as late as necessary. And that that's a decision between a woman and a doctor, because what you hear is this kind of really ridiculous argument that, like, you know, if you need a termination late on in your pregnancy, that that's like how people would use terminations for contraception. And that, you know, we all know that that's not the case. If you need a termination late on in your pregnancy, they are the saddest terminations. People who really want their babies, who are far on in their pregnancy, who are looking forward to it, and then get really, really terrible news. So that's what we'll be working to change in the legislation, that everybody who needs access to the care will get it. We need to really look into why different service providers aren't providing abortion care. Like, you know, there's some counties with absolutely no provision, and so people are still being forced to travel in other ways as well. But a lot of that is probably to do with the absence of legislation around safe access zones, which was in the programme for government and has yet to be implemented. So lots of stuff to work on for the repeal review. I know there's a protest happening around this on the 25th of September. If any of your listeners want to get involved, even via social media, every little helps. But yeah, it's a big priority for me. Obviously, I got engaged in politics through those social referendums. So to go from that to now being able to actually try and do something about it and, you know, put forward different suggestions for the legislation feels like a real privilege and honour, and kind of a coming full circle. So I'm excited to work on that.
I think, okay, and I accept that this is something that's really important, and it has to, there's so many complexities. And I just also think it's in a part of politics where we do it badly, where we seem to do something and then say, well, we did that, we move on, as opposed to, we've did that, how is it working in 12 months' time? What do we need to fix about it? What do we tweak? What do we change? And I know that that's certain, you know, that's actually almost across the board. And one of those things that you're also involved in that was done, and we're all supposed to move on, was the Mother and Baby Home Commission. And that's something else that you know, whether they believe they did it correctly or they did it, they fudged it, and then they came back and fixed it in some ways. That's something that you're also going to be working on in the new term. I'd be interested to get your thoughts on that, Holly.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked about that, Tony. It's something that I think, if I probably weighed up, you know, obviously the perception from outside of Leinster House is that everything goes on in the chamber. But what one thing that I learned is that an awful lot of the actual work happens on the committees. And I'm so glad that I've been on the Children's Committee that's dealing with all of the legislation in relation to the mother and baby institutions. And it's been a really fascinating process. And I don't know how much your listeners will know about how this works, because I certainly had no idea before I got onto a committee. So I think it's just important to highlight this. What happened? You know, I think your podcast have recovered it before, and I spoke to you about the commission's report on the mother and baby institutions and what a fudge that was. So I won't go into all of that because I think it's been covered. But say, coming from there, there's two pieces of legislation that are coming through the Children's Committee. One was originally called the Dignified Exhumations Bill. So that was, you know, we came to a conclusion that, like, all of this horrific, unimaginable stuff that happened to these institutions, to women and their children, that ultimately, you know, we don't know where children sold abroad illegally for money for the religious order. We don't know if they're in some of these mass graves. And that ultimately, it's high time people were able to find out the fate of their disappeared relatives. So if that meant exhumations and DNA testing and then reinterment and a dignified burial, that's what we need to do. That was kind of the conclusion, I think, that the nation has come to. Everybody wants, you know, finally to give people their information, the whereabouts of their children, all of that stuff. So it started off being called the Dignified Exhumations Bill. Then what happens is then the department draft legislation. And the first step with that legislation is they give it to the relevant committee, and the committee do a report on it. That's called report stage. I'm just explaining that because I didn't know, and maybe all of your listeners do know that. But interestingly, at that report stage, so we had one public meeting with the minister, and then the rest of them were done privately, which I personally think is problematic in itself. All of this should be public, because I don't believe that people would say the things that they said at report stage if it was a public meeting, you know? Why is this stuff going on behind closed doors? I have no idea, you know, just to highlight that.
When you compare it to Canada this year, and Canada has discovered mass graves of children in Catholic institutions, and they've already exhumed and given respectful burials to those children. We're over 10 years since the Tomb Babies, and still they're dragging the feet. I can't believe it's still going on. I simply cannot believe it. I think they have zero respect for those children who died in those institutions. Zero respect. And they simply don't want anybody to know.
Yeah, and for those who survived those institutions. But so then, interestingly, when the draft legislation came to the committee, the name of it had changed from, you know, we were referring to it as the Dignified Exhumations Bill. The name of the legislation, the bill, had been changed to the Burials Act, the Burials Bill. So I think that language is important, because that change in language was very representative in the draft legislation. And what we saw was that, you know, instead of intervention being based on suspicious or unlawful death, intervention was now, according to this legislation, based on manifestly inappropriate burials, i.e. the septic tank and tomb. And like, I think we all agree that that was just one of the most harrowing stories when we found out that there was over 800 infants and children in a disused septic tank. Like, that really did hit home. But I suppose ultimately, the nature of the burial doesn't mean that one person is more entitled than another to find out the fate of their disappeared relative. So, you know, I was really just, my mind was blown to see that this is where they were going with the legislation. The intervention would be based on the nature of the burial rather than the suspicious or unlawful death. And like, everybody who was in one of those institutions who's has a disappeared child has the right to know what happened, where they are. Are they in America? Are they in one of these mass infant graves? You know, like, there's about 900 potential infants and children in a grave in Besborough. And this is like all over the country. So, you know, there was one public meeting where I, you know, really pressed the minister on this. Like, do you personally think that intervention needs to be based on the nature of the burial or the suspicious or unlawful death? And I will send you the link to that if you want to put it in the, you know, the blurb, notes of this podcast, because it was quite interesting. And then what we did was we went through weeks of the committee then. So this is, then it goes into private session. And we had so many long meetings. And I would like to give credit to the chair, Kathleen Funchen, of the Children's Committee. She is a saint. It was very intense. And, you know, ultimately, I'm not allowed to talk about what happens in these private meetings, which is why I'd like to highlight the fact that I don't think that we should have them. But I will summarize the nature of the events. I can't repeat anything that was said, but I would like to say that ultimately, many of the members of the committee, and now the vast majority of them, to be honest, didn't show up because they don't bother showing up to private sessions because the public don't see that they're not attending. This is very important, what we're dealing with. So it would be good if people showed up to the meetings at the very least. However, they didn't. Most people didn't. And then the attempts from many of the members were to, you know, really reinforce that disciplining the coroner, you know, making sure that intervention would only be based on those so-called manifestly inappropriate burials, all of that stuff. And like, I think one of the things that we really need to highlight on this is, like, if you zoom out, we have laws in Ireland around suspicious deaths. So like, you know, in this committee, do you know what was raised? People's property rights.
Yes.
Not the rights of the people who, you know, who have a right to their own information about themselves, about their children, all of those things. And like, people on the committee were more worried about people's property rights, genuinely. So like, we have a coroner's act. The coroner is obliged to act if there's remains found in its district. There's also a second thing on the coroner's act which makes them obliged to act, and that is if somebody dies in state care or custody. So there is no argument for the fact that the coroner hasn't already acted, you know. And like, if you isolate one incident, if I had, you know, remains in my back garden, the guards would be in, the coroner would be in, nobody would care about my property rights, and rightly so. But for some reason, that has never happened. And there is, like, the case of a survivor, Anna Corrigan, who went to the guards and reported her siblings as missing people, you know, and nothing was done. And now they're creating legislation that disapplies the coroner and, you know, legislates for not having any intervention in certain sites because of the nature of the burial. So the next stage of this is that we go on to committee stage. So then we'll start to make amendments to legislation. We send our report to the minister. And it was interesting to see how this works, because when there was obviously a real clash on the committee, there was some of us who were not okay with the legislation in the way that I just described to you guys there. And there was people who, you know, wanted the opposite, essentially. And the only way that we ended up actually reaching a compromise was because, from my understanding of it, was the threat that we made of producing a minority report, that we wouldn't stand over a report, certain members of the committee that said all that stuff, said we'd produce a minority report. And people just really didn't want that, because, like I said, it's a private session, and I suppose that would expose the reality of what happened in those very long, very stressful meetings. But I suppose, like, it was just a real, I think it kind of showed how the state has treated these issues, like try and shove it back under the carpet, try and disregard people. And people would say things to me like, Holly, we find it, you know, inappropriate and offensive that you're using words like mass grave, as if I was being sort of dramatic or blowing things out of all proportions. And like, what do you call 900 plus infants in an unmarked piece of land? Like, that is a mass grave. So I suppose what I really felt was that, like, how have these women continued to fight for their rights? And I'm just in such awe of them. Like, we see the recent publication of the Magdalene Laundrie's book by various survivors and advocates. And like, they are consistently doing the work that the state should have done and should be doing. And they do it tirelessly. And it's just, you know, it's incredible to see that. But for all of your listeners as well, heads up, like, what happened in October when the department was talking about, you know, sealing the archives for 30 years, saying that GDPR didn't apply, that people weren't entitled to their information. The public outcry is the thing that really helped survivors and to get justice, that they changed their tack. And it turned out the Attorney General said that GDPR did apply, because obviously we all know that European law supersedes that out of date Irish law that we have anyway. But when this comes up in relation to the burials, I hope that people will engage, because I think there can be an outrage fatigue with issues like the mother and baby homes. You know, we get so sick and tired of being outraged about this, and it's so exhausting, and, you know, it's not covered enough in the media and all of those things. But just, I hope that people will tune in, and because the importance of this is huge, like, finally people can find out potentially what happened to them, what happened to their children, their siblings, their relatives. And we need to ensure that does happen, that this isn't, you know, a repeat of the other legislation we've seen for, like, the Ryan report, the McAleese report. Yeah, and then the other thing coming through the Children's Committee will be the adoption information and tracing legislation. At the moment, the draft legislation doesn't allow you to find out information about your siblings, for example. It doesn't allow you to find information in relation to, like, your health files or the adoption files, and all of that is crucial. And ultimately, you can't help but feel like, oh, there, that with information's being withheld because it, you know, potentially incriminates somebody else. And then that's used as, oh, we can't release third-party information. But, like, it has to be released.
Well, we've spoken to some of the best legal minds on this, and it doesn't stack up, you know. And you mentioned the GDPR, they got old advice, they got the AG's advice when it was predated. All of this was a fudge. And you're right, outrage fatigue is an issue here. It really can be. But at the same time, I think what's a bigger concern to me, and you mentioned private committee, and I've seen things that have, you know, there's situations where things have been done at private committee, say in relation to the climate committee and things like that, where you're going, okay, so this piece of legislation was proposed and then it went into private session and it emerges something different. And you're going, okay, so, and no one takes responsibility for it, you know, and it is a danger to that. And then obviously it then falls on legislators then to try offer amendments and try and, but you're almost fighting back to just make these changes to what at the outset, like the change of language, as you pointed out, that's chilling, actually. That's chilling. You know, removing the word dignity is just horrendous. And it just shows you what we're fighting against. Holly, I suppose that brings me to one question that this is your first term in the Dáil. I'm assuming, based on what you've said, it's been a rude awakening, has it?
Yeah. I was only on the council for 8 months, but I remember thinking that inexperience was in many ways my biggest weakness. But actually, I think it turned out to be our biggest strength, because when you have these fresh eyes on something and you just realize the outrageousness of some of these situations, like, what is the point of private session? You know, I don't actually have any understanding of why we have some committees privately. We should all be willing to say what we're saying publicly. Why have a private session for something like that? It's outrageous. And it was the same like on Cork County Council. When I went in, they would put a big document on our desk and then say, you're voting on that now. I was like, I haven't a chance to read it. But that's the norm on Cork County Council. So obviously put forward, you know, a motion to change that kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, it is to see how democracy works in Ireland is always fascinating. And it is an awakening to see the reality of how it operates. So we did our podcast inside the chamber at the time to expose the inner workings, how government does or doesn't work, local government at the time. And we are going to revive that for inside the Dáil chamber, just to highlight some of these particular issues around like that private sessions of committee meetings.
Agriculture is also in your brief, Holly. And you have there's the common agricultural policy. Do you want to tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, agriculture is one of my main interests. I grew up on a small dairy farm and it became unviable. My mum's a farmer. You know, around the time Simon Coveney lifted the milk quotas, a lot of the small farms in Ireland just became completely unviable. So then we went into beef and sure, you can't make any money in that. So now we still have dry stock cattle. We've planted half the farm in native broadleaf forestry and we do vegetable seed production. So yeah, I grew up, I suppose, on a farm and then I went on to do a master's in it, the importance of seed adaptation in the face of changing climates and all of that. So I suppose like that, I said, you know, repeal and marriage equality and things like that really got me into politics. But the motivation to continue in politics, you know, the injustice around marriage equality, the injustice around reproductive rights, they were sort of, in a way, to a certain extent, for the most part, dealt with. The motivation to continue in politics was very much climate change. And, you know, having grown up on a farm and to see the deterioration of small farms all around me, and then as a knock-on effect of that, the populations in rural community, employment, and the massive environmental impact of all of these terrible decisions. And then this whole narrative that actually these policies are for farmers and environmentalists are trying to take them down randomly to ruin their lives. Like, it's just something that has always blown my mind. How has this narrative come about? And I think, you know, we're going into the CAP discussions now. And what we always see then is that we'll see this hone in on details, like this much going to this scheme and this much going to, you know, and all of those particular arguments. But there is the real need at this point to zoom out and look at our agriculture policy in Ireland, because I was always under the impression that common agricultural policy, you know, we know that that's like a European thing and that it was very much European law guiding how Ireland, you know, managed their agriculture sector. But ultimately, Ireland's interpretation of CAP is what's going on, because you see other countries taking a very different approach and a much more sensible one. So I suppose for one of the things that I'd like to highlight in relation to CAP is that the narrative from government departments and, you know, often media and farming lobby groups is that, you know, the result of it is that the very communities that will be the most affected by climate change are actually really resistant to climate action. They think it's going to decimate rural Ireland, this kind of thing. But ultimately, like I said, since we've lifted the milk quotas, we've seen an increase in the kind of intensification of Irish agriculture, the demise of the small farm, and then, you know, it's not going to affect the local post office closing, the school, all of these things. But ultimately, Ireland is very unique in the European context in that a third of our emissions come from the agriculture sector. You know, there's no getting away from that fact. We have, you know, according to all of the scientists now, we have 10 years to do something about this, the world. You know, it's not. And then the other argument here, oh, well, China like are producing so much more in the way of emissions than Ireland.
I got to come in even on the emissions side and just bring it back to agriculture, because we're hoping to speak to Sinead Moles shortly, who's done a great report for Oxfam. You may have seen. And one of the findings in it is that at present, only 11% of funding in Ireland is directed towards projects that support principally sustainable agriculture. We also have a real problem with food sustainability here, and the way our agriculture is built, we don't understand how exposed we are. We can be sitting around, and you see people at the moment mocking empty shelves in the UK because of Brexit. We are really playing with fire when it comes to our own processing of food and how heavily we do it, and we just don't direct the funds or the cap or the way we do it into things that will deliver. So it just seems to me, taking the climate issue, which is huge. I accept that. But if you want to put it on people's dinner tables, let's look at it in that way as well. Because if you want to talk in I'm going to say this in Gaeler speak, you don't want to go hungry, folks.
That's it. And a really good, you know, so yeah, food insecurity is a massive problem in Ireland. Something we don't talk about enough. We used to have like food banks at sea and stuff. That's all gone. We saw the potential for empty shelves during COVID. You know, I remember one day seeing an article that like, had COVID come into New Zealand on a frozen packet of food. You know, like just to think about that for a second. And then, you know, when you think about our land use, it's mainly now in intensive dairy production. A really good example of how Irish policy has driven this, right, is that on my farm, every year, like a department official will come out to the farm and dock us money off of our payments for areas that we have food growing. So you only get payments where you have livestock on the farm, essentially. That is what the government policy does. And then, so people blaming farmers is outrageous, and farmers having to defend themselves is outrageous. Like, this is driven by the Department of Agriculture policy. And we import then all of our vegetables from abroad. And we have, I remember going to an event before, and there's someone from the IFA saying, oh, you can't grow vegetables in Ireland, really. That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Like, Holland, really small country, produces the second most amount of vegetables in the world after the United States of America. We have a better climate than Holland for growing vegetables.
We don't need all the soil. We don't need all the greenhouses they have. We can actually just grow them without the mass production.
Well, we would need greenhouses for a lot of.
I just find like Holland's landmass is tiny compared to Ireland's in terms of population density. We're such an outlier. We're the second least dense thing. There's no reason why we can't do this. But again, going back to that, I don't think people get it in Ireland how at risk we are. A couple of bad knocks to the global economy and we have a food shortage.
Exactly. Yeah. We're 2 days away from protests about it, really, of no foods on the shelves and stealing food off each other and all of that stuff. But yeah, I suppose ultimately as well, then like the approach that you see or the kind of, you know, greenwashing that will go on now during the CAP talks, be like, oh, well, there's this, you know, the REAP scheme, the new REAP scheme, the Marianne new REP scheme and the GLAS scheme and all of that. And like, ultimately, it doesn't make any sense to be like, oh, here's this tiny environmental pilot project. And then here's the whole rest of the country. You know, and there's like organic farming versus farming. And ultimately, What organic farming, what is that? That is farming before the introduction of chemicals. And like, it's no coincidence that the people who are really doing the best out of this new style of farming are the chemical companies, the big international agri businesses, not the farmers. And ultimately, the way we need to be moving with policy, when you consider the urgency of it for the industry, like it's a huge economic important department for Ireland. We need to preserve our agriculture sector because we need it. We need to change our practices. And instead of saying, here's an environmental scheme over here, and then the whole rest of the country is going to be farmed in this really irreversibly damaging way, we need to be saying, here's how we change the entire policy. So I really reject the whole, this small section over here for organic farming and for the GLAS scheme and for the REAP scheme. We need to change our practices, whole scale, wholesale. And, you know, stop. It's like we see it in housing, and we don't often see the Department of Agriculture as a public service like we do housing or health or whatever, but it is. And people, you know, need to kind of, I think, realize how much it affects them as well. If you eat food, this affects you. And what we see, you know, with the Housing for All and it being developer led, our agriculture policy is led by those big companies.
Well, when you mentioned the, because we've spoken to guys from on Art of Glass and Call of the Small Farmer Association that do all of these things, which are real, like tiny farmers growing fruit and vegetables predominantly and maybe having a suckler herd and some issues. And all I could think of is the guy saying, well, look, in the new plan, we have cost rental. And you're going, yeah, it's like 2% of it out there. And the main trust of it is still developer led. So, you know, it's the same model, but you've just put a little bit on top.
Last question from me, Holly, and then we'll let you go. We know you're busy in there today. What does success look like for the Soc Dems this term?
This term of the Dáil or this entire
this term,
year?
This term of the Dáil.
What does success look like for the Soc Dems? Well, I suppose from a personal perspective, I would say, like, I really want to finally see the easing of the maternity restrictions in hospital. I've worked on this issue for a year now. I'd like to have an impact on CAP. I'd like to ensure that the legislation around the burials bill allows everybody to find out the fate of their disappeared relatives and allows survivors to get the access to all of their information. And then, you know, when you go through the different people, like Cian is amazing on housing. I'm sure he's got similar aims and goals in that department. Roisin's working a lot on the staunch care issue, all of the senior officials in the implementation group resigning. So I suppose we all have our own individual goals. And as a whole, as a party, they're all the same goals.
I think you've said really a lot there, but I think it's important that we point out at the end, the Roisin was involved at the outset on Sláinte Care, and the slow death of Sláinte Care sped up over the last few days. And we've got, like, the Taoiseach has been on record as a defender of private health care, and that's not, I'm not saying anything that he hasn't said himself. Within the party, there must be a lot of disappointment on that.
100%. Like, it's, you know, it's a core policy for Social Democrats. Obviously, like you said, Roisin Shortall, our co-leader, was kind of the architect of it, chaired the committee. And I suppose it is like the benchmark socially democratic policy. It means an awful lot to the Social Democrats. Like, and this is what I always think, that everybody in Ireland is a Social Democrat. They just maybe haven't realized it yet. If you ask any Irish person in the street, do you think you should be more or less entitled to healthcare based on how deep your pocket is? If there's a child who needs healthcare, of course, we all believe there should be equal access to healthcare. We spend 20 billion a year on our healthcare services. Of course, that's enough money to have, you know, a national health service with equal access. But of course, it's the same as, like we talked about, in the Department of Agriculture, in the Department of Housing. It's those private interests, those private hospitals. You know, and like, yeah, I mean, when we went into the discussions around the programme for government this time, and into government talks, like, Sláinte Care is an absolute red line issue for this party, housing policy. And that is why we didn't end up in government, because they clearly weren't going to happen.
And we were so close. We were so close to having the private hospitals within the system. We were a hair's breadth away from it, Tony, during the lockdown. Holly, thank you so much for coming on and having this chat with us. We know you're very busy there, and we've covered quite a lot today, and I'm sure we'll have another chat and cover a lot more between now and Christmas as well. But thank you for taking this time to have this chat with us today.
Thanks, Martin. And can I just say one last thing, sorry, in relation to that, because the Sláinte Care and all of this stuff ties into something I think that's quite interesting. So like I said, for a year now, I've been trying to, you know, work on getting restrictions eased in maternity hospitals. Won't go into all of the reasons for that. I'm sure all of your listeners understand why I would be doing that. But it is quite fascinating, isn't it, that, you know, at this point, the Taoiseach, the Minister for Health, everyone has said, we want those restrictions eased, and they are not. So, like, the government does not have control over health services. That is so obvious. And when it comes, you know, to women's healthcare, we know how damaging it has been to have, you know, religious organizations orchestrating that, from the mother and baby homes, all of that stuff. And ultimately, those religious private organizations owned a lot of our hospitals. And, you know, you see what's happening with the maternity restrictions. Like, we cannot allow our national maternity hospital to be owned by Sister Charity or St. Vincent's Holding Company. Just to highlight that, like, that, I think that really comes down to the crux of it. What's going on with Sláinte Care? What's going on with this? It's those, the private ownership of our hospitals. It has to end. It would have a massive impact on so many of the issues that we're working on.
Holly Cairns, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Best of luck in the new term. Stay in touch, and we will be keeping an eye on what's going on. We are coming, I think we're talking Finland, actually, funnily enough, tomorrow, Martin, and we're hoping to speak to talk about that Oxfam report that we referenced as well. We're hoping to go back to Sinead and talk about that as well. So there's lots more coming, and we really appreciate it. And folks, we will be back to you very soon. Take care of yourselves. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.